before their hashtags.
A dissection of pop culture past.
With Eric Dallinger.
And Carly Anna Billings.
Each week we hop in our time machine and take a look at the past of pop culture.
Hello, wonderful listeners. This is the Before There Were Hashtags podcast. We're back after 2 weeks.
Hello, host,
Eric Dallinger, and we are here with my lovely co-host, Carly Anna Billings.
Oh gosh, that's me. Hey, hi, howdy. How are you doing? How are you doing, Eric?
I am doing good. I'm feeling relaxed a little bit.
Good.
Because I've had a little bit of time off because summer camps came to an end.
A nice breather.
Not teaching annoying children anymore. Well, I should be careful. If you are listening, children, you are not annoying. Just kids in general are annoying. It doesn't matter who they are.
Yeah, having to sit and deal with a gaggle of children on a daily basis.
Yes, very taxing.
Taxing, absolutely. Doesn't matter if they're lovely kids or not so lovely kids. It's just hard. And I think a lot of people have realized that throughout this pandemic. A lot of people have had to sit with their own children longer than they normally have to and have realized,
yeah,
that's hard.
All our parents being like
absolutely
secondary teachers while our real teachers are all on the computer. Yeah, but people are realizing teaching is a hard job.
Right? Teaching is one of the hardest jobs, I think, just in general.
Summer camp, not to compare myself to a school teacher because, like, mad respect. But what makes summer camp hard, too, is that, especially dance camp, like, you don't have as much. You can't just, like, send away the kids to, like, do math problems. Like, have, like, 40 minutes, do your math work. Like, you don't have that doing dance.
Yeah, like, quiet, like, self-work. No, it's hard because not only do you have to teach these kids, you also have to entertain them.
Yeah.
So it's like you're doing double duty in that way, being with them for so long. I think that's true with any teacher who has to teach, you know, some form of arts.
Yeah.
Maybe not visual arts because you can kind of leave them to do their art. But like when it's like a performing art, I think you have to not only be teaching and making sure they're learning, but you have to be entertaining. You have to entertain them.
Yeah. Vocal teachers, I'm sure, have like the same thing where it's just like they're always on. Like you can't just like shut off for like a little bit.
Totally. I remember like when I've taught like scene studies or when I've taught, you know, acting or even when I've taught like things like, yeah, voice or movement. It's like exhausting to try to like keep the attention span of you know, especially children, and in a group, and to keep, make sure that they're also learning and enjoying themselves. And it's a lot.
And in like a camp setting, it's like all day, right?
It's all day. Yeah.
Where like, for sure, you know, like when you're doing like teaching dance, right? Like during the year,
you just see them for their class and they're done.
Yeah, they're there for an hour and then you're like, bye. Like, you can get, if it's a bad class, you're like, well, that's over. But like, bad camp, you're like, ooh, bad camp day.
You're having
a hard camp day. You're there for 6 to 8 hours, depending on the length of the camp.
Totally. You live like four different lives from like the time that it's when they get there, till the time it's lunchtime. So like, it's really a totally different thing. And so lots of kudos to teachers of all kinds, molders of young minds, parents.
People that have to
just spend time with anybody for so long.
Teachers of all kinds,
teachers
molders
of all kinds.
Young minds.
That's right.
That's a very nice rhyme.
I could do
a RuPaul's Drag Race verse.
We made one up and it took us,
I'm
what,
just
10
kidding.
Seconds?
Have you seen those YouTube videos that are like every single Drag Race rap, and it's just like people like, get sick to get fitted up, ba-ba. I'm the best and you're the best. Like, it's like,
it is. It's like
all the patterns that they ever use on Drag Race.
It's because it's easy and they have to do it fast.
Carly, how are you?
I'm good, Eric. Thank you for asking. I am a little sleepy, just because I
know it's a big week for you.
A sleepy vibe. It is a big week for me. It's
a big
exciting.
Week over at Ghosts Are Everywhere.
Sure is currently. And by the time this is released, it will have happened last week. Absolutely. Yeah. It's Ghosts Are Everywhere's 100th episode.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
And you're starting a Patreon. Yeah.
Oh, that's true. It's already been announced, so we might as well talk about it. Yeah.
Are we allowed to? It will be out by the time this comes out.
No, yeah. It's already been announced. Yeah, it's going. It's doing. I'm sure it's doing great. Let's put that out there. I don't know. It hasn't launched
yet
by the time of this.
Thousands of people.
So many patrons that we shut down Patreon. It's very exciting. It's like... I even have this with our show, Eric. Like, I can't believe we're on our 21st episode. I'm like, what?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And for me and Cecilia to be on, like, having done our 100th episode to hit the triple digit, I was like, I don't understand. I remember it was exciting when we hit double digits. And I was like, episode 10, that's a milestone.
I know. Episode 10 was a milestone for us, too.
And it feels that way. And so, yeah, to hit 100 just feels like... We couldn't possibly have told pretty much like over 200 ghost stories, but we have. Yeah, so it's weird but exciting, and yeah, feels great.
Yeah, I'm so happy for you guys, and like
Thank
I only
you.
Aspire for us to one day get there, 100th episode. And I if you are interested in Ghosts Are Everywhere, the 100th episode, a certain person that's on this pod makes a little guest appearance on the 100th episode.
Sure does, sure do. Thank you for doing that. It's very.
Of course, I have to plug myself.
Of course you have to. It's how we do.
I'm an actor. I plug.
We've got to. We've always got to be, you know, self-promoting. It's what we do.
It's what we do. Networking.
They work it into you and then you can't get it out. That's who we are.
So much fun. Well, we are here. We are back.
Woo! We
Talking
are
about
back. It's
pop
exciting.
Culture. We have a good one today.
I think so.
We're talking about...
I'm pretty pumped about it, honestly. It's a topic I honestly feel pretty passionate about.
Yeah.
No surprise. Ghosts Are Everywhere. This is kind of those vibes.
A childhood non-classic.
Honestly, though, for me, a childhood classic.
I know, but it's not really regarded as one.
No. It's regarded almost as like an anti-classic.
Yeah.
In the Disney dogma, in the Disney, you know, zeitgeist.
Of course. I'm going to give it away. We are talking about the movie that almost killed Disney animation, The Black Cauldron.
I know. I'm sure they've seen the title. I'm sure they've seen the description of the episode.
Yeah. It's probably going to be called The Movie That Almost Killed Disney Animation, The Black Cauldron.
I mean, it's
title of
app. Fits, girl.
In the Lost Culturistas podcast that I listen to with Bo and Yang and Matt Rogers, they always they try to come up with their title of ep during the episode. They're like, that's it, that's the title of ep. So I just
that's
pulled
so
one
funny.
Of those. I have to stop plugging other podcasts on this podcast.
It's a classic.
Or maybe it's a podcast community.
It's right. Podcasters are supporting podcasters.
I'm just waiting, Bo and Yang. Are you gonna shout us out soon? Come on, Bo and Yang.
Come on our show.
You wanna come on our pod?
You're welcome.
Because Bo and Yang from Saturday Night Live knows who I am.
Maybe. You never know.
Weirder things have happened. Weirder things have happened. We're all 6 degrees of separation. Like,
that's it, baby.
I can get myself to the Queen of England.
That's so true. Why don't you do it for our listeners at
home
real quick?
So I was in a show in Prince Edward Island, yes. And the artistic director was Annie Allen, who lovely woman. And she was the private ballet tutor to one Diana Spencer, Princess Diana herself.
That's right.
Crazy. That's so awesome. And of course, Princess Diana knew the Queen of England. So through, what would that be?
Two
in the middle between me and the Queen. But...
Yeah, there's two between you and the Queen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that means that there's three between me and the Queen, which I'm into. Too.
Yeah. And that means most of our listeners are probably close to there, too.
Yeah, you're welcome, listeners.
You're welcome. And let's not forget, the Queen has met everybody from the Spice Girls to Lady Gaga, so.
So, yeah, consider everyone the Queen's ever met, we're that close to those people as well. So.
But isn't that crazy that I can get myself faster to the Queen of England than I can to, like, Lady Gaga?
Yeah. It's just how life is. It's, like, weird.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I could get myself to Lady Gaga other ways, but I don't know them off the top of my head.
Yeah. It's, this is just a quick, speedy route.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. First year, for sure. Well, Eric, should we get underway so we can talk about this mammoth of a movie we've got coming?
Sure. You want to discuss? Do you want to gas up this time machine?
I sure do, so that we can go back to the way back, baby.
Yes.
And of course, the way that we do this, we all know this, is we talk for 5 minutes about today's pop culture in order to guess up our time machine so we can go back and talk about yesteryear's pop culture.
Oh, and it is a doozy today.
Ooh, let's do it. I don't even know what we're talking about, so I'm excited.
It is good. I want to get your reaction.
Okay.
I want your honest reaction. I'm going to start the time machine in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right. So, Robin Anton of the Pussycat Dolls is suing Nicole Scherzinger.
What?
That's
the news this week, is that Robin Anton is suing Nicole Scherzinger. On what grounds? For what?
So, I guess with the pandemic, because the Pussycat Dolls were supposed to go on tour.
Yeah, they were supposed to have their big comeback.
Nicole wants more money or more percentage of the business now that, like, she has to give up other endeavors now in order to do the Pussycat Dolls tour.
Sure.
So, Robin has sued Nicole, and this is Nicole's lawyer's statement on it.
Ooh, wow.
Robin will fail in her efforts to trade on Nicole's hard-earned success to pull herself out of a deep financial hole she has created by her own poor business and professional decisions. Nicole loves and respects the Pussycat Doll fans and hopes one day to be back on stage performing the group's amazing hits for them. Sadly, this will not happen under these circumstances. So basically, what has turned out is that Robin Anton and Nicole together created a business called Pussycat Dolls Worldwide, and that would sort of be like the brand of the Pussycat Dolls. And as it originally stood, Nicole had 49% of that company and Robin Anton had 51% of that company.
Okay.
And Nicole wants to, in order to go back on tour, wants to increase her ownership of the business from 49% to 75%.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And in the public records that, in the public records, it states how much each girl would roughly stand to make from the tour that Robin put out. So it was like each of the girls were going to make something like 12.5% of the net profit. Nicole was going to make 32.5% of the net profit. However, Carmeet Bakar was only going to make 5% of the profit.
Whoa.
So, and like part of the reason why Nicole's suing too, or Nicole is like, one of the things that Nicole's like jumping on them is that like Robin revealed like confidential information about all of the girls' pay contracts. Information and how much their contracts and how much they were all going to make.
Absolutely.
So it's like nuts. Oh, just when we thought we were going to get PCD back.
Oh, we really were like, it'll be soon. Don't worry. And then now it's like, no.
Nope.
Oh, boy.
Sorry. Yeah.
Oh, boy. It always comes down to that, eh? You know, the dollar line. The money.
Dollar bills.
Yeah, dollar bills, y'all. That's so wild. Like, I don't... I mean, I guess Nicole has her reasons. It sounds like, yeah, because she doesn't want to. But the thing is, like, Nicole, girl, like, everybody has to, like, move their shit around because it's been a pandemic. Like,
yeah, Nicole's lawyer said this is the reason why that she thinks she deserves this increase of profit, yeah. Is for the growth of her own personal brand and the opportunities she would have to forego to engage in the partnership.
Yeah, so, no, girl. Also, there's no, like, what? I can't imagine. Maybe money-wise, there is something that is more lucrative that she's missing out on. I doubt it. But also, the Pussycat Dolls, like, for clout is the biggest thing she's a part of. So I don't understand.
No, yeah.
I don't understand. Do you understand from like a branding point of view? Like, I don't understand from a branding point of view.
Nicole, and that's what he's saying. Nicole has never been more successful than she was with the dolls.
No. No, because she is like the front girl of the dolls. Like she's the face of it. When you think Pussycat Dolls, that's what you think.
However, yeah, she knows that too, that she, without her, like if the right. four other girls went on tour without her, it wouldn't really be the dolls. They exactly. literally have dropped a member from the original lineup, right? Like,
yeah.
Melanie Thornton is not with the group, but like that's nobody, true. People are still like, yeah, but like it's still the dolls.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, it is mutual. It couldn't be Pussycat Dolls going on tour with five new girls and just Nicole, right? Yeah. It has to be those girls, but it could have been like, it could have been.
Like Nicole plus maybe one or two of them, and then some
yeah,
other
it could have
people.
Been like a trio, like Pussycat Dolls reunite with like three of the girls, and
you're
Nicole
not,
had to be one of them.
You're not gonna go see Fleetwood Mac without Stevie Nicks, like
yeah,
they
but,
you could. They've tried, but
yeah. also without the other people, it would be just Stevie Nicks and not Fleetwood Mac.
Exactly, then you'd be at a Stevie Nicks concert.
As my like my thesis of our Pussycat Dolls. episode was that Nicole needs the dolls and the dolls need Nicole. It is mutually beneficial, and we've reached 5 minutes.
Yeah, wow, can't believe it, but also can totally believe it. I'm not surprised, but also I'm shocked,
mean,
you know,
we've always known Nicole
is the
wants control. She likes the control.
It's her. That's what she's here for. Yeah, we talked about that a lot. If you missed it, you could go back and listen to our very first episode where we really dove deep into the politics of the Pussycat Dolls. But today,
we are diving
in to something else.
Yeah, talking about disputes. This
Real
movie
big.
Has behind the scenes had tons of disputes.
Right. So we're talking today about Walt Disney's The Black Cauldron. In 1985, Walt Disney released an animated dark fantasy adventure film called The Black Cauldron.
Yes.
It was the 25th Disney animated feature film, which is like pretty, like that's kind of a big deal. Like 25 is a big,
it's
you know,
celebrating anniversary.
One of those special numbers, you know, right?
Yeah.
And this is the movie they released for it. It's based on the Chronicles of Prydain. By Lloyd Alexander, which is like a 5-book
series
about
some,
like based
Tolkien-esque.
In Tolkien-esque, based in like Celtic mythology, but is very fantasy. Sounds honestly pretty sick. Like,
yeah,
I kind of like I'm looking at it and I was like, oh, maybe I should have read that as a kid, you know.
It was directed by Ted Berman and Richard Rich.
Yeah.
Richard Rich. That's like...
Richie Rich.
Richie Rich. That's also like that psychologist named Eric Erickson. It's like...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Like, it's like you have the same
two
name
names?
Two times.
Same name two times? Okay. Cool. Yeah.
The name's so nice, they named them twice.
So, yeah. This movie is kind of... colloquially known as the movie that almost killed Disney animation.
Yeah, it was really the one movie that really could have tipped it the wrong way.
So the plot is pretty basic. It's this this guy, he is a pig farmer. I watched it today. I watched it for the first time today.
Yes.
He's a pig farmer and he wants to be a warrior, and then he finds out that his pig is a magical pig that can tell the future. Weird.
So great.
There's
so
this
great
kind of war going on in the land, but you never see the war. Against
no, it's kind
the
of
Horn
set
King.
In like fantasy medieval times.
Yeah.
Is when it's set as well. So yeah, Taran, like you said, is a pig keeper. He's like an assistant pig keeper, this like little peasant guy. And the pig that he's keeping is this pig named Henwin, and she's the cutest pig in the whole wide world. Just these big, beautiful eyes, and she's a little snooty little pig.
Yeah, I wouldn't make
and
that
she...
pig bacon.
And she can like, yeah, she has, it's like an oracle. She can tell the future and shit. And it's amazing. And then there's this his badass friend, Princess Ayanwi, who he like meets along the way, and she's so cute and adorable. And then they meet this weird like scruffy like dog thing called Gurgi along the way, and he's endearing. And all along, yeah, they're trying to prevent the Horned King from getting this thing called the Black Cauldron. Because if he gets the Black Cauldron, essentially, he's going to raise an army of the dead and they're going to take over the world. Like, that's basically.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah, they pull a lot from the first two books of the Chronicles of Prydain, but they don't. It's very tiny tiddly bits. It's not really anything.
Well, the Horned King is actually just a minor villain in the books.
Yeah, he doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
But they were like, this is our guy.
This is our big bad.
Honestly, he is the big bad. He's terrifying. My sister to this day, if someone brings it up, she goes, oh, the Horned King. And she goes, no, I'm not. It's not for me. Because he's like scary.
Oh, he is scary.
He's the Horned King.
He's a cross between the devil, like Satan,
yes,
and a skeleton.
Yeah. Yes. Because that's the thing. Like, this movie, if you watched it and didn't know what studio made it, you would have no clue in my mind that this is a Disney movie. It does
no
have
clue.
No classic hallmarks of no Disneyisms that we've come to know and expect. Even like pre, like, because Disney has had a lot of different eras, and this occurs, you know, in
the dark.
Well,
era.
Actually, in the dark era, what some might call the dark era.
Like, I know all the Disney eras.
Sure. This movie, it took a long time to make as well.
Yeah.
So they announced the budget. The announced budget was $25 million, but apparently it was more like $40
million. Yeah, it took around $40 million to make.
By the time it was done. And it was the most expensive animated film at the time that had ever been made.
Mm-hmm.
And the Disney optioned the 5-volume Prydain series in 1971. And this movie wasn't released till 1985.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quite a long time. But yeah, let's get into the Disney eras.
Yeah.
For a quick second to give us a where and when we are.
Yeah. So Disney has always gone through. This is of course Disney Animation, not the whole Disney company.
Yes.
But
absolutely,
there's different eras of Disney. So the Golden Era, which is 1937 to 1942, consists of movies such as Pinocchio, Fantasia, and of course the first ever animated feature, Snow White. From there, Disney goes on to make more propaganda films, and so that's the wartime era, and that's 1943 to 1949. And you wouldn't really recognize any of these movies. They're like Melody Time, like maybe that's the only one, but they're
Melody Time.
More like
but they're mostly shorts.
Yeah,
and like
propaganda stuff for the war.
Totally.
And then we go into the Silver Age, which is 1950 to 1967. That is Peter Pan. That is Sleeping Beauty. That is Lady and the Tramp. Cinderella.
Oh, yes.
101 Dalmatians. And then
all the winners.
101 Dalmatians kind of brings into what is known, the nice name for it is the Bronze Era. The
yes,
what everybody else calls it is the Dark Age. So
sure,
the Dark Age, that is where the Black Cauldron fits in. We have Aristocats, Oliver and Company. Disney was going for a lot more experimental filmmaking at this time and its animation, and trying to separate itself from its more cutesy fairy tale, even though this is a fairy tale, but less bright and colorful. And then after that, of course, we bring in the Renaissance, which is the most famous Disney era, and that's Hercules, Little Mermaid, Pocahontas, Beauty and the Beast, Mulan, all Lion King, all the really good ones. And then there's post-Renaissance, yeah. And that's kind of like, they sometimes call that a second Dark Age. That's like Lilo and Stitch, Brother Bear, like
I know,
Emperor's New Groove. So many good ones. And now we're in
Treasure Planet. Yeah. Like, yeah.
We're in what's now known as the revival because people are really liking the movies with Wreck-It Ralph and Frozen and Tangled. And of course, this is not to be mixed in with Pixar. Pixar is a completely different animation studio that is just owned by Disney, but they are two separate animation studios. We are.
And a big reason why Disney fell into the Dark Ages real quick is because they lost people to Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
Originally,
yeah,
which is why Pixar, yeah, why their styles are so different, and why their success was so different for a while. But of course, they're the same company now.
Yes.
So, this project, The Black Cauldron, was a very ambitious project. Let's get that out of the way first. They hoped it to be the Snow White of a new generation of animators. They were really convinced that this thing was going to be, you know, a big freaking deal, which is, of course, why they spent so much money on it.
Yeah, they wanted that, like, classic fairy tale look that they pulled. His name, I believe, is Milt Kahl out of retirement. And he did a lot of the work on Sleeping Beauty because they wanted that, like, cinematic, widescreen. Creepy elements, like Maleficent elements to it. And it totally does.
And maybe that's a reason why I love this movie so much as a kid. My favorite Disney movie as a kid, I loved it so much I broke the original cover that it was in as a VHS, and my parents put it in, I had to buy a new one and put it in a new one, is Sleeping Beauty. It's my favorite. She's my favorite princess. It was my favorite.
She's only in 17 minutes of the film.
I don't give a shit, Eric. I'm obsessed. It's so dark. It's so freaky. It's so cute. She's pretty. I love it. Okay.
Sorry.
Prince Philip is just a blonde nothing man. Come on. Sign me up. Right? I know.
He's a total himbo.
Come on. He's a total himbo. Sign me up for the himbos. Tell me where they are. I'll help them learn how to put pants on. I love that. But yeah, maybe that's a good reason why I love them so much. They're very similar in style in that way. Especially since this was the first film in 70mm widescreen since Sleeping Beauty.
Yes, yes. However, there was a mistake, and the 70mm didn't fit. They weren't quite the right size. It was this huge mistake that they made, so they had to redo the machine slightly in order to make it work.
Yeah, for like months they had been drawing and painting in the wrong cell size. For the 70mm by accident. Like, that's the thing. This movie hit so many different roadblocks. The project kept getting delayed. Yeah. Again, it was supposed to be a masterpiece to launch careers and become an animation classic. That's what they were always aiming for when they, you know, optioned this series and decided to make this movie. The project kept getting delayed. And the studio chief at one point, Ron Miller, who was Disney's son-in-law, he kept delaying it because he thought his animators weren't ready for it. He was like, it's a huge thing.
Yeah, we're not ready.
They're not ready. Yeah. But then in 1979, animation star Don Bluth quit Disney. It was a huge thing.
Yes.
And he took 13 colleagues with him from Disney Animation.
Yeah.
Leaving behind like a skeleton crew. Like,
isn't that the start of DreamWorks?
You know, animators. Yes.
Yeah. It's the start of DreamWorks.
The drama of it all.
He like leaves. Yeah. He gets mad and is like, if you don't want my ideas, you don't want to do what I want to do, I'm leaving. I'm going to create my own company called DreamWorks. And then DreamWorks, works with Universal a lot.
Of course. And it's like, he literally like up and took a bunch of the animators, and they were left with very few seasoned animators and then a few new untested recent CalArts grads, one of whom was
Tim Burton.
Yes. I think it's pretty funny. Yes. Longtime collaborator with Disney. Now,
other one was Tim Burton. Where I have it, sorry. Was it John Lasseter?
Yeah.
They were like these two graduates, and this was like one of their first movies. And John Lasseter would, of course, go on. Like, he was huge at Disney during the Renaissance. Like, he is largely responsible for the Disney Renaissance. But this was one of their first films.
Well, that's the thing. At this point, it's like, here's these nobody kids and, you know, the leftovers who didn't leave for DreamWorks. And it's like, it puts this big project they've been building towards for, at this point, like 8 years. They were like, well, we'll put it off because, you know, we're not ready. Now they're really not ready.
The first director was John Lester, and he left. He had to leave the project because he started working on The Great Mouse Detective because they just kept laying it on him. He was like,
oh my God, and The Great Mouse Detective is so fucking good. It's so cute. That's another movie I loved as a kid. But finally, production began in 1981, pretty much 10 years after they
got the rights.
Yeah, absolutely. And so with it, Disney hoped to draw in teens with this movie. They were like, this will be our movie for the teens.
Yeah, so producer Joel Hale was quoted as saying, no respectable teenager would be caught dead watching a Disney movie. And so they kind of made this movie in order to sort of appease a little bit of an older audience. And employees joked that Disney was so, like, clean and sweet that if they did a movie about Hitler, it'd probably be called That Darn Hitler. Like, that was, like, the running joke about how sweet.
They're like, shucksy doodle
that Hitler. Like, that's how sweetsy they were. And so they wanted to switch it up with this.
Yeah, they really grunged it up for this. They decided to appeal to, you know, a group of people, teens, that they previously had, you know, ignored pretty much, or cared about, and hadn't really cared about cornering. In a decade and climate of, like, Dungeons and Dragons, Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, Goonies is released the same year as this movie. It's like the perfect, I think, thing for this group of people. Like, if they were going to reach out to them with something, they really came with a hard hitter. It just didn't land.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of the reasons why this film did not land. Around 1984, the film is finished and they
One thing before we get into that real quick. It was also it had a 6-track Dolby sound, so it sounded good, it was supposed to look good, and it also was the first computer animation ever featured in a Disney film. So they really came to the table, they thought they were doing something.
It was also the last used a multiplane camera in animation.
Yeah, so it is this really interesting, we'll get into it in a second, but it is this really interesting hybrid time of new and old.
Yeah,
it was, old school, it was new school.
Which is really neat. Like, it has some of the last like effects of the old world of animation and has some of the latest computer animation. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
It is really cool. And I saw a picture of the machine that they use for the multi-plane camera. It's so cool. Like, it's layers neat of different cell art so that they can move them independently.
Yeah, to hand freaking paint a cell.
It's gorgeous.
Like, that to me, it's so old. It's so beautiful and gives such an interesting, you know, complexity to a scene. But it also, like, is so freaking old school. And to think that they were doing this in the 1980s at Disney is just, you know, blows my little mind a little. But yeah, so let's get into, you know, what the heck went wrong here, besides, you know, some of the things we've already
been doing. So around 1984, they do a test screening of the film for some kids, some families, and mothers walked out with their crying children because it was so freaking scary.
It's so scary. And those crying children were all my sister Kara. because it was so scary because the Orange King is terrifying.
In fact, if they had released that version, some sources claim that it would have been rated PG-13. Others claim that it would have been rated R. It was that scary.
Yeah. And I don't know if we mentioned this. This is the first Disney movie to receive a PG.
Yeah, I was
going to
get into that. Yeah.
Like, every movie up till this point had been a G rating. Yeah, That Darn Hitler rating, you know. But yeah, the fact that kids left this test screening freaking crying, I'm obsessed.
So,
I'm obsessed with that.
Yeah, so studio chairman Jeffrey Katzenberg saw the film and was so horrified by it that he demanded that edits be made right away. And what happened was the director was like, we can't do that. This is actually not a thing that we do in animated films. It's too challenging. once the film is done, we don't do post edits. It's just not something that we do. Jeffrey Katzenberg.
because that's not how animation works. Like, also, real quick, the reason that suddenly Jeffrey Katzenberg is here is because in the fall of 1984, just months before Cauldron's planned release, Ron Miller, who was the animation studio head,
he left. He was fired. Oh my goodness, I knew that.
Yeah, he was fired when the company chairman, Michael Eisner, became the company chairman, and then he appointed Jeffrey Katzenberg as the studio chairman. Neither man cared about animation. At one point, they even considered eliminating the whole division. But yeah, so just a little earmark of who the heck is Jeffrey Katzenberg. He's the guy in charge of animation now. So, and he says, "Give me cuts." And they said, "Buddy, that's not how we do this."
So then Jeffrey Katzenberg goes into an editing booth by himself and starts editing the movie himself.
He's cutting this up like snip here, snip
don't
there.
Don't like this.
Let's do it
this
together.
Is too scary.
Don't give a shit. Yeah, don't care about your beautiful animation, the 10-minute sequence of, you know, anything that looks cool. This is not Fantasia. Get it gone. Like, he does not care. And it is wild.
Yeah. So scenes that were cut include, so for story wise, they cut a lot of the fairy scenes because they were like, they're not really important to the main plot. And they're like, it's just too long. But also, spoiler alert, the Cauldron brings the dead back to life. And there was
surprise,
a full like 10-minute scene of the dead coming back to life that was so scary that they had to cut it. And this included one of the members of the undead grabbing a living person and melting their skin off to the bone.
I'm obsessed with that. I would love to have seen that.
And that was like the scene that was making children cry.
Children were like, we don't want to see that. That's not what we signed up for. We're children.
But I mean, to be fair, they left in when the Horned King gets like zapped into the cauldron. It's horrifying. His skin comes off. It's horrifying. I mean, it's amazing.
They also kept when Gurgi jumps into the cauldron himself.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
And
spoiler.
There's
alert.
Room.
Which is the part that ruined me as a child. I was like, my friend Gurgi, there he goes.
There's also
the best of us, who we all have been making fun of. Here he goes, saving us all. Anyways, go ahead. Surprise! Spoiler alert. Sorry, you didn't want to watch this movie, listeners, did you?
Because we're gonna spoil it. Sorry. there was scenes. This is kind of more rumors. They haven't found these scenes, but there was supposedly shots of like full stabbings and like people getting their heads cut off in the film.
Oh,
and that
wow.
They cut those out because those are not appropriate for a PG rated audience.
They were like, we need a PG rating at the very least. So we'll cut that.
Cut. Yeah. So because of these cuts, the movie was supposed to be released in a 1984 holiday release right before Christmas.
That's right.
But instead it was pushed to 1985 summer, so 6 months later. And some people believe that that is one of the reasons why it didn't do so well at the box office, because winter is usually more family movies. Families go to see, and then summer tends to be more summer blockbusters, and a little bit more adult films come out in the summer.
Right. Though, like, one could also argue they were trying to hit the teens with this. Like, they were trying to hit a different group. They weren't trying to hit the tiny children with their families, in a way.
In a way, but because they cut all that stuff, it became a little bit more child-friendly. No. Not quite enough.
Well, I mean, no teen's going to want, no 13-year-old is going to want to go see a PG-rated movie when they could see a PG-rated 13 movie.
Exactly.
You know? So, you're totally right. But yeah, also at this time, which is really interesting and speaks to the like chaos that was the animation studio right now. They also, so Michael Eisner, famous for, if you know anything about Michael Eisner and Disney and the Renaissance, he was huge for expanding the Disney brand into bigger and better theme parks and attractions. He was really into that aspect of the business. He really didn't give a shite about what content Disney was creating, except for generating money in a like attraction based way.
Yeah.
He was really that kind of a guy, to the point where he would, you know, did a lot of
things. He's kind of just honestly, so much. He's a bit so of a, like things. A controversial figure in Disney because
he's totally
in many ways like we have him to thank for keeping Disney alive. Because it would have really, it wouldn't be the mega giant that suffered. It is today. It wouldn't be the money making machine without him. But at the same time, a lot of the sort of creative cuts that Disney has made is also because of Michael Eisner.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. He was very business oriented. He was very, let's do a bunch of lavish things to make a lot of money. And not necessarily, he didn't really have that kind of artistic vision, artistic eye.
One thing that he did that I was actually really interesting, I watched a whole YouTube video on this, that Disney's live action at the time basically saved the company.
Yeah.
Their strategy was to hit, it was called hitting ones and twos. So they would make cheaper movies. So that way, if they only made $10 million profit on it, it wasn't a big deal because they only spent like $10 million on so
they were trying to make the most with the least. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now it doesn't mean that there were bad films, it just meant that they were simpler, smaller scale movies, and they didn't hire big stars to be in them. They would often go with television stars and give television stars their big break into film.
Yeah.
Because at the time there was a clear delineation between television stars and movie stars, and so television stars were often cheaper if you wanted to put them on film. And he saved Disney basically by doing this, but because of that, he has a bit of a lack of respect for Disney animation because it, of course, costs a lot of money to make an animated film.
Totally. And also he was like him and Jeffrey Katzenberg are responsible for like rounding up the studio essentially and taking it from their cushy spot in Burbank, California and moving them to like a little warehouse in Glendale where they would encourage them to work faster and work like
harder.
Like, exactly what you described, which is a spend less, work faster. Out more with less. Yeah.
They were thinking about shutting after this film is done because it did so poorly. It took $40 million to make and it only made 20 and it only made something like 22 20, million.
20, 21 and change. Yeah.
Yeah. So they lost a lot of money on this movie. So they were like, we don't care about the animation. We're going to move you to this warehouse and we're going to make you feel. And they're like, if you want to get back into the cushy place, like you better work hard. Because we're thinking about shutting down Disney Animation because our live action over there, they're actually making money. And you animated people, you just lost us almost $20 million. All the money.
Yeah. Which is like really not surprising because of the climate of the time. But also just like wild to think of now. Like to think of all the movies that maybe never would have happened had they, you know, just shut it there and then. We wouldn't have any of the Disney classics that our generation thinks of as Disney classics.
But, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, did it work? Can we...
I guess.
Can I be a controversial figure and say, did it work? Because it did. We got the Disney Renaissance out of it. We got the Little Mermaid. They were inspired. We've got to work harder. We're going to create the Little Mermaid. And then they made, like,
these
beautiful films. They made Mulan. They made Pocahontas. Which, I mean, I know a lot of these movies are now a little bit problematic, but they are classics.
Yeah, they still slap. Like, I'm still singing just around the river bend. And I'm freaking
hashtag
a good
is better
boy.
Than like, Colors sorry. Of the Wind, just saying.
Like, yeah, it's a huge problem. That's a whole other issue that we don't have time or capacity to get into today is, you know, the problematic, just history of Disney in general.
I forgot one little fact.
Sure.
In 1982, there was a 10-week animator strike that this film had to do that put the movie back.
Yeah. Again, things like even while it was in production, pushing this movie back, like it was like this movie had the world stacked against it. Like it was really just not. Well, it was just not.
Also, it's hilarious that Disney bought the rights to The Chronicles of Perdan. Is that, am I saying that correctly? Perdain?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Perdain, I think.
Yeah, the Chronicles of Perdain. And they only used elements from the first two books.
Yeah.
Like, and
they optioned all of it.
Disney
technically, they still own it.
Oh, Oh, we'll get into that.
Okay, good.
So, yeah, so they bought the rights to all five books and only used elements of the first two. And Disney Animation was like, we do not do sequels. We do not want to make sequels.
Yeah.
In fact, we can get into it later when all of Disney does do sequels. That's a whole separate animation studio.
Thank you, Michael Eisner.
Yeah, that's a whole separate animation studio, just so people know. Little fun fact about the Disney Renaissance. All your favorite sequels, Mulan 2, Lion King 2, made by a completely different animated studio than
the original. And you can tell.
Oh, yeah, you can tell.
But also, I don't care. I'm going to watch it.
But... yeah, so they bought all five books and only used the first two. Yeah,
totally.
And the writer...
intended to do nothing
also,
with it.
The writer, like, because of the source content, and they bought these... they bought the rights because, of course, in the 1970s, it was such a time for Tolkien, and it was such a time for epic fantasy in literature. Yeah. People were really enjoying that. And, of course, Lloyd Andrew...
Lloyd Alexander.
Lloyd Andrew Webber.
Lloyd Andrew Webber the second.
Lloyd Alexander wrote, this is what he had to say about the movie. This is his quote. First, I have to say, there is no resemblance between the movie and the books. Having said that, the movie itself, purely as a movie, I found very enjoyable. I had fun watching it. What I would hope is that anyone who sees the movie would clearly enjoy it, but I'd also hope that they'd actually read the book. The book is quite different. It is very powerful, powerful, very moving story, and I think people would find it a lot more depth in the book. So, yeah, this is a very pared down, lots of liberties taken adaptation.
I mean, well, Jeffrey Katzenberg cut 10 minutes from the film in the end. He cut out 10
15.
Minutes.
I heard it was 15.
15?
It was 10 minutes of it were the undead coming back to life.
The undead scene. Okay, yeah. Then you know what? He cut so much of it. But I think a big reason why it doesn't have the depth maybe that it could is also at the time. Again, we talked about how this movie is a bit of a hybrid of new school and old school in a lot of ways. And one of the ways it was from old school is... what they would do in order to create an animated film is they'd storyboard.
Yeah, they didn't use scripts didn't come first. It was first storyboards and then scripts.
Yeah, exactly. They would storyboard it out, what it looked like, because it's such a visual, you know, medium, right? And they can manipulate it how they want. And so then they would add in, you know, the storyline. And that works really well for, you know, a simple fairy tale like Snow White or even Sleeping Beauty. Like, you can fill in the dialogue as it goes.
Yeah. Stories where the point A to the point B is like a straight line.
Yes. Yeah. But for a story like this that already has such complex narrative, it didn't work out so well, which is why it was the last of the Disney animated features to work by storyboard as well. And, you know, now they work from screenplays like every other movie.
But once again, I think that it's like a lot of lessons were learned, right? Because the Disney Renaissance comes because they put so much emphasis on story and so much emphasis on working music into story so that the music was furthering the plot. And that's another thing. This is the first and only Disney film to not have any songs in it. Not just that it wasn't a musical. It didn't have songs. Yeah. It only had background music.
A score.
Now, I do think the score is beautiful. I was like...
the score is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like... this score is awesome watching the movie today.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't have a song that you can leave the movie theater singing like, I know you. Hi-ho, hi-ho. It doesn't have any of that. It has none of it. It just has Let's Be Scared of the Horned King Forever vibes, which I really appreciate and love. I mean, I was also one of those weird kids that like loved Sword in the Stone. Like I'm a sucker for a darker Disney film. I don't know.
For sure.
I've just always been that way. But yeah, so one of the scenes though that didn't really suffer, you know, the wrath of Jeffrey Katzenberg or, you know, or Michael Eisner or just like any of the tribulations that, you know, befell this movie is one of the very first scenes, and it's a very dramatic scene of when Taran's oracle pig Henwin is captured.
Yeah.
It's like, think of how, like, it is so stunning. Like watching it as a kid, I was like, this is something special. And it's just like it's one of the it's like the inciting incident literally of the movie. The pig gets stolen because the Horned King wants to use the pig to find the cauldron, and his like pterodactyl henchmen come in and scoop this pig up, and the sky changes, and it's so scary, and it's really sad, and it's so cute.
And I will say one of the victims of them making two books out of five is that the witches, I didn't understand the witches, and I thought they were kind of funny. I liked them, but I was like, are you guys good? Are you bad characters? Like,
yeah, you're like, what are you doing?
Like, where do you fit in the story here? Like, you could just kind of pop up, but I liked them. I thought they were cool. I thought they were funny. I just wanted more of them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know. I don't know.
Like they're witches. Just there. I think witches are cool. I love witches. So I wanted more of the witches. I love the busty witch that's like, she loves him.
Oh, she's my favorite.
She's the best. Yeah. And then the other witch tries to eat him. It's funny.
Right? It's so funny. Yeah, it's such a weird, it's such a weird movie the more I think about it. Yeah, it's got everything. It's weird. It was, you know, almost ruined an empire. It it's just got all the, it's also so 80s.
Can I give you some really fun facts?
Please do.
Okay, so this is kind of like an urban legend that the creator of Zelda, well, first off, this movie was somewhat big in Japan. It did well in Japan.
Good for them.
The creator of Zelda,
they know good things,
was very inspired by it, and a lot of the imagery of Zelda is inspired by this movie. That's urban legend.
I love that.
Another fun thing is that in Disneyland, in Tokyo Disney, in Disneyland Tokyo, a ride called, people should go look at Defunct Land. It's a really good
YouTube channel. If you want to go down a hole of the things that Michael Eisner has done,
it's a really great
place to be.
Tokyo Disney, there's a ride called the Tour of Cinderella's Castle. And the idea is that it's kind of trying to trick you. So, like, you go in and it's supposed to be like, oh, we're going to go tour the castle. And then the mirror, like, comes up and it's like, why are we highlighting the heroes? We should highlight the villains. And then you go through what is, like, a Japanese horror house where it's, like, it's supposed to be really scary. It's unlike a Western haunted house. Things don't jump out at you. It's a little bit more about ambience and, like, terror in that way.
The vibe of it all. It's not like a jump scare situation.
But the big climax of this ride is this movie with the Horned King.
I'm obsessed.
It was much bigger in Japan, and they basically made it the centerpiece of this ride in Disneyland Tokyo, the Magic Kingdom.
I love that.
Tokyo Disney.
Yeah. We get it.
Tokyo Disney has two parks, right? So there's Magic Kingdom and Disney Sea. So I just want to be clear. Yes.
Just trying to make it clear so people, if they want to go see it, they can.
Well, it's not there anymore.
But also, it doesn't
defunct.
Exist. Yeah. Defunct. There also was a restaurant that was renamed Gurgi.
We watched the same YouTube video.
I see. I didn't watch a video. Surprise! Oh, y'all want a twist, eh?
Let's get sickening.
I didn't watch the Defunct Land video on it.
Oh, this wasn't Defunct Land. This was a different one. I'm just trying to look it up because I do want to pay credit to it because I took a lot of information from it.
Oh, love it. No, I found that on our good old friend Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is Sarah Sterling, just so people know. That's where I got a lot of my information. And also on an article on Slate called The Black Cauldron is the movie that, and it's called The Black Cauldron, and then the subtitle is The Movie That Almost Killed Disney Animation. Really that bad? Is the movie that almost killed Disney Animation really that bad? That's the article I read. Ooh,
yeah, I also read that Slate article. Yeah. I also read an article on tour.com. As well as the Wikipedia.
I just want to give credit because sometimes I think I forget to give credit.
We love it.
And I don't come up with all this information. There's a lot of great people that do that. But there I do find is. It.
We... We're but the, you know, tellers of the knowledge. We're not
the storytellers.
Scribes. We're the storytellers. We're not, you know, the researchers necessarily. We research what other people have researched.
Yes.
And that's how we work.
It's like writing an essay, right?
Totally. It's totally like writing an essay. But yeah, so this movie is a lot of things. It's loud, it's gross, it's scary, it's dramatic. It's, for me, almost everything you would never expect from a Disney movie, but in the best way.
Well,
because if you can't tell, I love this movie.
It's the most un-Disney-like Disney movie that Disney ever created.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it does have a bit of a like cult following because of that. It has a like, there's a lot of nostalgic, you know, 90s kids who are like, yeah, that movie, I'm obsessed. Well, like, what I've learned is my friends that I, if I bring it up to them and they've seen it, they're probably, you know, a little freaky. Pal of this pod, Cecilia O'Grady, also loves the Black Culture.
Of course she would. She doesn't like the sound of music.
That's right. Beef. That's right.
Well, luckily for her, Disney has rebought the rights to the Chronicles of Perdam.
That's right. Yeah.
In 2016, they did that. So they could be potentially working on either another animated film based off of the books, or they could be working on a movie series or a television series for Disney Plus, because, you know, they have so many options now.
Really could be. And also, it's a 5-part book series. It would do well as, I think, a TV series.
Yeah, one season per book. Five seasons.
Come on. Right? Or even stretch that out if you're willing. No. But yeah, I love that. I didn't say I was willing.
Yeah.
I just said if you're willing. Yeah. But I'm very excited to see the future of this. I hope they do it in a different way, in an exciting way. Because I would want, like, this is a series of books I'd want to read. But if Disney's going to make a series, I'll probably just watch that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's be honest.
Let's be real. I don't read books that much. Real. I know. That sounds awful.
Let's be real, Disney.
I have dyslexia. That's why I don't read books a lot.
Yeah, exactly. You have a reason. My reason is just I watch too much TV. So
TV is just so accessible.
Go figure. I know. Well, what can
speaking
you do?
Speaking of TV.
But yeah, speaking of TV, I think that lands us back in present day.
Yeah, so we can talk about our puppets.
Just in time. For some sweet, sweet pop pics, baby.
Carly, your picture went down. We're on Zoom, by the way, people. Carly didn't have time to meet me in person. I'm Carly.
Hey.
I'm so busy. I have so many opportunities. My other podcast has a Patreon. We made it to 100 episodes. I'm Carly. I have a lot of opportunities. I'm doing trivia night.
That is true. If folks who are in the Hamilton area want to join me on Saturdays in September at 8 p.m. at the Blue Collar Pub on Hamilton Mountain, I'll be hosting trivia with Hub of the Hammer. So,
I'm Carly. I'm plugging my trivia night.
Oh my God, your me is pretty uncanny. I do sound like that.
Yeah, you do sound like this. And I wish the audience could see me because I am shaking side to side.
You really are. You have your hand on your hip, and you're really giving it to the camera.
I am an actor.
I'm really into it.
I studied Carly, and I am Carly. Yeah, I am
now.
Carly. I hope, audience, you like that bit.
I buy it. You're all welcome for it. Eric, what's your pop pick of the week, my baby?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so my pop pick.
Give it to us.
Is called Below Deck. It is this trashy reality TV show. I'm watching it on Hey You, which is, of course, a reality TV show streaming service. thanks, cuz. Thanks, Amanda, for giving me your password. And I've been thoroughly enjoying it. And yeah, I love it. I want to be a yachty. I actually don't want to be a yachty, but.
Honestly,
I just want to be
though.
A passenger. I don't want to work on them. But they make bank doing
that's
that.
That's fair.
They get like $1,500 in tips sometimes from like a 3-day charter.
Wow. Because people are rich.
People are rich.
Eric, people be
eat
rich.
Eat the rich, but I want to be the rich.
But also have the rich give us their money, period.
Yeah. All right, Carly, what's your pop picks?
My pop pick is a TV show that I watched all of last weekend because Pal the Pod, Cecilia O'Grady, and I went to Ottawa to visit a few friends.
Gosh.
And our beautiful friend, Axond, we stayed with him, and he introduced us to, and we watched the whole thing of this TV show. It's two seasons, just shy of two seasons. It's a TV show everyone is talking about on Apple Plus called Ted Lasso.
Ooh.
And it is great. It's really
Apple
good.
TV Plus,
I'm rewatching it right now.
The only streaming service I do not have.
It is very silly. It's Jason Sudeikis. He plays this American football coach.
Nice.
As in, like, the game football in America here. Yeah. You know, touchdown, that football. And he gets roped into coaching a British football team, as in soccer. And it's, you know, there's hijinks and it's silly. And it's really, it cuts deep, though. There's a lot of emotional turmoil in this show for such a funny show.
I like Jason Sudeikis.
It's really, it's well written. He's so charming in this. He just plays this dad with this mustache who's a coach. He's so cute. They're all so cute. Yeah, it's a great show. I learned a lot about football, soccer that I didn't know. Like that there's different leagues and that if you don't do well in a league, you can get demoted to a lower league. And then you could also, if you win that league, you could move up. There's... England is crazy, y'all. England's got a lot on their plate with their football and their boots and their
monarchy,
tally-ho, and the queen. There's
Meghan Markle.
There's so much, right? Biscuits. Like, there's
that,
just
that
so
pants
many
are underwear and trousers are pants.
And trousers are pants, and like you have to mind the gap and
the Spice Girls.
So there's tea time. And dinner time are different, and it's just a lot. There's a lot there. IT.
I'm just
not
saying
low
a bunch
tea.
Of British.
That's what
isms.
I have.
The loo.
I mean, the loo. They've got the loo. They really see. There's
Hello.
So much to learn.
Sorry, I'm being so weird. I'm like a little overtired. I didn't do anything today, but I'm tired.
And that's the name
that's
of the game.
That's the name of the
baby.
Game. Would you
Abba.
Do anything?
We love Abba.
What are the lyrics?
Oh, speaking of Abba, they just they're back. They released some new music.
All
it's
four
beautiful.
Of them.
We love it. Yeah, they released two. They released two new singles.
Surprise! I didn't know this.
Yeah. Oh, that's another thing we could have talked about today. But
sorry,
surprise!
I
in case
like,
y'all
have dolls, we have to talk about
that's
the
my second
dolls.
Pop pick. That's my second pop pick. My second pop pick is new ABBA. Listen to the new ABBA. It slaps. It's very,
also,
very good. It's like old ABBA, but they're old. You know? It's amazing.
Love it. Love it. Should we mention just a little, well, spoiler alert for Drag Race. Congratulations to Kylie Sonique Love, winner of All Star 6.
To our queen.
First trans queen. Woo! We love to see it.
Oh,
I know.
Finally,
awesome.
We'd love to see
and
it.
And that fall,
she's the
her
queen
somersault.
We love and deserve.
That recovery
that
was
incredible. Incredible. And she cringed. Did you watch her watch it? Okay, because I watched them watch it to see who got crowned. And she was like, she saw herself trip and she like cringed and all of them were like, yeah, but she was like, oh no. And she really thought that was going to be her downfall instead of a
I'm going to be honest. I didn't
it
see
so
it
cute.
Coming. Kylie winning. I sort of thought that the whole season was working to Ginger win. And yet Raja kind of became the front one runner at one point for me. But I'm happy for Kylie because I think she's awesome.
For me, it's been pretty much a toss up between Ginger and Kylie. So I'm so proud.
I mean, my
of
true
her.
Favorite were
amazing.
Jan and TKB, but...
We know. Oh, we love them. It's just the best. Drag Race is such a fun, dumb thing that we love.
Did you watch
do.
The Canadian Extravaganza anniversary special on Crave?
Sure
I
did. Did you?
Man,
was it good?
It was like a reunion, but like it was like the reunion episode of regular Drag Race, just a whole year later.
Year later, yeah. Which is why I was like, am I interested in this? Maybe not.
Scarlett and Alona Verley just still
Alona,
going at it. Like
going at it. Which makes no sense.
Those two,
like
get
over
they
it.
Just can't. They just can't. They can't coexist.
They can't
but
coexist.
They love each other. They're also like best friends, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, which makes
Sissy.
No sense. It's like...
Sissy.
That's a like beautiful but toxic friendship.
Boa called out Brianka. Yeah, Boa was like, really? Brianka, you only call any of us now when you need something. And I thought it was a joke at first. I thought they were gonna be like, ha 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 ha. Nope.
You're like, ha.
Nope,
ha.
Wasn't a joke. It became like a whole thing.
No,
on
Boa
that
really
episode.
Meant it. Oh yeah. No. I mean, why? Like, not to be this bitch, but she doesn't have to call it. She's
what?
You know.
I didn't hear you.
I just mumbled for a bit and then mumbled, but she won, so who cares?
I know. Like, Jimbo cleared up that she doesn't think he was robbed.
Oh, good.
I love Jimbo. It's my special day.
I love Jimbo. Jimbo was my winner.
I know,
winner.
Jimbo. Jimbo it and Lemon, special but day. They're going to be on the international season.
Yeah. We get to see them, yeah, with a bunch of other queens,
so
which
exciting.
Is very exciting. Yeah.
Okay, we're probably annoying our audience, and so we're gonna sign off. Thank you so much for listening to Before There Were Hashtags. We appreciate and love you so much.
Thank
spread
you
positivity
here.
And love into the world
we
because
sure
you know it's a hard time for some people going back to school. It's like weird.
Totally.
The weather's getting a little cooler, which we it's love, totally but not weird. Everybody likes it.
Which we love.
So we're
going
to peace
spooky.
Out. Thanks for listening to Before There Were Hashtags. Follow us on Instagram.
In the words of my new favorite, Danny Rojas, I'm in the business of joy, and I want to spread it for free, baby. Have Ooh. Some from us. We love you, and we'll
Bye-bye.
See you next week.
Bye.